The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's John Dennis on Thursday, June the 5th. Today, no dream ticket. The former US President Jimmy Carter tells Barack Obama he shouldn't choose Hillary Clinton as his running mate.
I think it'd be the worst mistake that could be made. That would just accumulate the negative aspects of both candidates.
Also today, the government's plans for polyclinics won't improve patient care. That's according to an influential health think tank.
The idea of a co-located polyclinic is something that we haven't really experimented with on a large scale in this country.
And how Prince Charles plans to export his Poundbury philosophy, promoting traditional building styles, to China.
There are only around 1,000 Tutongs left now in Beijing. I think that's less than a third than there were just a decade or so ago.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and a look at today's papers from Sandy Waugh.
Any teenager over 16 found carrying a knife in the street will face prosecution, the Prime Minister will announce today. Gordon Brown will host a knife crime summit at number 10 with lawyers and police chief. Minds have not yet been made up on how to treat teenagers under 16 found carrying knives. A student will appear in court charged with the murder of a schoolgirl found stabbed to death in a block of flats in South London on Monday. He's 21-year-old Thomas Nagus from Essex. Arsima Dawit was stabbed 10 times. And her body was found in a lift. NHS patients will get a poorer standard of care if the government goes on merging GP surgeries into bigger polyclinics. That's the report from the think tank, the King's Fund, which thinks that super surgeries with a wider range of services may be less efficient. We'll hear from the author of the report in Guardian Daily. A House of Commons committee says one in five NHS organisations are in the red. The NHS as a whole had a surplus of over £500 million, but 81 different organisations, from strategic health authorities to primary care trusts, went over budget, say the MPs. The head of the army has demanded a pay rise for his troops. An army briefing last month showed many ordinary soldiers were slipping into poverty. Now, Sir Richard Dannett says servicemen and women who are putting their lives at risk on the front line are paid less than traffic wardens. China is now planning a huge reconstruction after the earthquake. The government's decided on standards to ensure much greater safety for the future and will begin rebuilding schools, homes and hospitals. They estimate the work will take 3 years before the victims are all able to leave their temporary homes and tents. At the same time, there are still warnings over lakes formed by landslides in the earthquake, flooding existing homes. Hillary Clinton has said she will give up the contest to become the Democratic Party candidate for US president. She'll announce it in a speech in Washington on Saturday. Negotiations are still going on behind the scenes to see if she can persuade Barack Obama to put her on the ticket for vice president. Obama is the picture on the front page of most serious papers, and also The Sun, which says he has a dream, copying the famous phrase of Martin Luther King. But The Guardian says Obama is resisting Clinton's pressure to be his running mate. The Telegraph and The Guardian feature the OECD report warning of a major downturn in the British economy. It says house prices will go down 10% and 200,000 jobs will be lost. Finally, The Mail claims council officers are now using anti-terror powers to read emails and listen to phone calls to catch people smuggling dogs or storing petrol illegally. More on the day's news plus breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Barack Obama has already made history this week by becoming the first African-American to become a Democratic presidential candidate. But after the longest ever primary campaign, there's increasing speculation that Obama will make history again by asking his main rival, Hillary Clinton, to accept the vice presidential ticket. In an interview carried out before Tuesday, when he endorsed Obama's candidacy, the former president Jimmy Carter told The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland he believes it would be a mistake for Obama to choose Clinton as his running mate.
I think it'd be the worst mistake that could be made. I'm on the outside. I'm not involved in the internal affairs of the Democratic Party at all. But I think that would just accumulate the negative aspects of both candidates.
How so?
Well, I don't know if I want to go into any detail about it because I don't want to...
But just explain what you mean by accumulating or magnifying the negatives.
Because of Bill Clinton's elements of unpopularity, I have been against Hillary. It shows up in all the public opinion polls. I think hard negatives are about 50%.
Yeah, very high, yes.
So if you take that 50% who just don't want to vote for Clinton and add it to whatever element they might be that don't think Obama is white enough or old enough or experienced enough, or because he's got a middle name that sounds Arab.
You could have the worst of both worlds.
You could have the worst of both worlds. And I don't if she should have gotten the nomination, I don't think that it would be good for her to bring him in either.
For the same reason.
For the same reason.
You mentioned the legacy or the leftover effect of him,
yeah.
Bill Clinton. And I'm just wondering...
There are a lot of good aspects that he left
absolutely
over, too.
Right. But his role in this campaign, a lot of people have wondered about that. And you've made a vow you and your wife would not endorse during a primary process. Okay. A lot of people feel that the nature of his campaigning... people understand why he had to campaign for his wife, but the nature of it, the buttons he's been pressing, has not been appropriate for a former president. What do you think about that?
I think it has hurt him in the public opinion polls, as indicated by some that I have actually seen, and also by the editorial comments, even among editorialists who in the past have been fervently pro-Clinton. I think they have interpreted some of his remarks as being subtly of a racial nature. One that's been singled out is when he equated Obama with Jesse Jackson, I believe in the South Carolina primary. And the next day, Bill Clinton called me on the phone, and he told me that that was not his intention. And I believed him. I don't think that he deliberately meant to make a racist remark, but...
It had that implication.
But when he equated the fact that Obama would do well in South Carolina... And the main reason he did it was because he was like Jesse Jackson. It obviously was interpreted that way.
Jimmy Carter, and you can listen to a longer version of that interview on Saturday and read Jonathan Friedland's interview with Jimmy Carter at guardian.co.uk/America. Well, will Obama heed the advice of the ex-president? Ewan McCaskill's our Washington correspondent. He believes Obama will not choose Clinton as his vice presidential candidate.
I personally don't. Hillary Clinton definitely wants the vice president ticket, and she wants to be the candidate. But Barack Obama's side are pretty reluctant to do that. With the campaign over, there's this huge wave, especially among the media and Clinton supporters and some people in the Democrat Party, thinking, you know, dream ticket, she's got 18 million votes, she'd be perfect, she'd bring on board Hispanics, women, you know, blue, white-collar workers, it would be perfect. But Obama doesn't see it like that. His team think this will pass in the next few days or few weeks.
Jimmy Carter also acknowledged that some voters will be put off voting for Obama. I mean, George Bush has been a hugely unpopular president. Poll after poll shows disillusionment among American voters with the Republicans. And yet many senior Democrats do seem to be concerned that Obama may not beat John McCain.
I think that there's such a wave of revulsion against the Bush administration in America, and that any Republican candidate is going to suffer in November. But you know, having said that, there is concern about Barack Obama. You know, the biggest concern is race. It was a factor in the Democratic race. It sort of surfaced in places that could sort of surface again, and it almost certainly will surface again in November. What was amazing about those primaries, there were people who would actually go on the record saying that race was a factor in their vote. And if you think that for everyone who went on the record, there'll be lots, lots more who may privately think that, but wouldn't actually say it to reporters or pollsters.
We should remember, of course, though, that Obama's nomination is a huge milestone. You know, in living memory, black people have had to fight for the right to vote.
Race is still a big problem in America, but this is landmark. When you think that the civil rights era wasn't that long ago, we're thrown back to the sort of 60s and the 70s and the sort of fight for equal rights and the end to segregation. At that time, the idea that there would be a black Democratic nominee was just inconceivable.
Obama's main theme has been the promise of hope and change to years of economic turmoil and war. Do you think that will continue as he battles McCain?
I think so. I think that's going to be the central theme of this campaign. And you can see already, in terms of he's 46, McCain is 71, and in August McCain will be 72. So it's easy to portray McCain as the candidate of the past.
Barack Obama, of course, voted against the war in Iraq. John McCain, of course, has been a staunch advocate of the Iraq war. I mean, will Iraq be a big issue between now and November?
You know, funnily enough, if you'd asked that question a year ago, the answer would have been, you know, Iraq would be the major issue of this campaign. But partly because Iraq has seemed to be relatively quiet in American eyes, because the number of US troops being killed in combat has decreased, and the sort of sense that things are becoming quieter overall in Iraq, it's almost disappeared as an election issue.
How do Obama and McCain match up in terms of funding? Because Obama's been a formidable fundraiser in his campaign against Clinton.
Obama's, you know, well ahead. He's built this sort of huge grassroots fund of supporters, and they can give lots of small donations. So that means he can go back to them time and time again. McCain is struggling again because of the sort of disillusion in the Republican ranks. Also, a lot of Republicans don't like McCain. They see him as the right wing are suspicious. They think he's too much of a maverick, too liberal, definitely not conservative enough. So you won't see the sort of huge funds going towards him that you will see going to Barack Obama.
Ewan McCaskill, and there's full coverage of the US elections at guardian.co.uk/America. Also on The Guardian's website today, the Orange Prize for Fiction went to Rose Tremain's novel The Road Home last night, and you can read an extract at guardian.co.uk/books/orange2008. Lawrence Kay says two more years of Gordon Brown will put the big economic decisions on hold. guardian.co.uk/comment is free to have your say on that. And we've got live coverage of England v New Zealand from Trent Bridge at guardian.co.uk/sport. Local family doctor's surgeries are being replaced by super surgeries or polyclinics under government plans. Well, these health centres would bring together GPs with a range of services such as diagnostic testing, minor surgery, blood tests and x-rays. But they'll result in no less pressure on NHS hospitals, according to a new study. It says patients will have to travel further to see a doctor and their standard of care will not necessarily be any better. The research is published today by the think tank The King's Fund, whose chief executive is Niall Dixon.
Well, it's an attempt to analyse what polyclinics, as we thought described by the government, might have in practice. And what it suggests is that while there are significant merits in trying to bring some services together to improve the access, the quality and the cost of services, there are significant downsides in some of the models which we looked at. And in particular, the report looks at the idea of congregating large numbers of general practitioners in one area with quite a significant number of specialists and a whole set of other services. And the effect of bringing all those things together into one under one roof, you would think, would give lots of much better services to local people. In fact, there are also significant downsides. The principal among them, I think, being first that, for example, elderly people may have to walk further to reach their general practitioner than they do now. And secondly, there may well be problems in trying to get all these professionals to work together.
Won't polyclinics ease pressure on NHS hospitals?
They may have the effect of easing pressure in some circumstances. On the other hand, we have a relatively scarce resource in terms of the number of specialists that we have. And therefore, there can be difficulty, certainly in some specialties, in spreading these specialists around a lot of different buildings, whereas at the moment they're congregated in one hospital. So there are swings and roundabouts here. There may be some advantages in doing that, but there also may be a downside as well.
What about the standard of care offered by polyclinics? Will there be any difference between them and the current system of GP surgeries?
One would hope that the standard of care would be as good or better once you put, and certainly there's some advantage, I suppose, in putting single-handed general practitioners in larger practices where they're able to consult colleagues and learn from each other. But there isn't actually a whole lot of evidence that suggests moving general practitioners in larger numbers together increases the quality of care. I don't necessarily think there would be a reduction in the quality of care either, I hasten to add, but the downside would be that it might be a more impersonal building, I suppose, for somebody to go along to. There's something quite attractive, I think, about the sort of quasi-domestic form of general practice that we have in some settings at the moment. And for elderly people, as I say, it could mean that they'd have longer journeys to get there.
Does the study find any difference between the willingness of people to travel to a hospital and their willingness to travel to a GP surgery?
There is some evidence that people expect to have to travel a bit to hospitals and are less willing with the idea of having to travel further to their general practitioner. But I should add that our analysis suggests that one doesn't say this is a bad model and that another model is a better model. I think it has to depend on local circumstances. So there may be examples of where it is right to build a larger unit where we can bring together some specialist services, certainly where individuals have access to better diagnostic tests, who may have access to other services like physiotherapy. And that may suit one area. Our anxiety is that the health service starts to impose a single model and stamp it all around the country. I think, first of all, the idea of a co-located polyclinic where you're bringing a very large number of people together is something that we haven't really experimented with on a large scale in this country, and that if we were going to do it, it would be a good idea to evaluate it, to test it out and see over 4 or 5 years how well it worked before we started replicating it in a large number of places. And secondly, that you do it just in the areas where it's suitable to do it, given local history, traditions, where existing services are, and so on.
Niall Dixon, Chief Executive of the King's Fund. My name's John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, as 21st century tower blocks spring up all over Beijing, Prince Charles joins a campaign to preserve China's architectural heritage. And what some remarkable recordings made in London in the 1920s tell us about the lives of West Africans. But first, Silvio Berlusconi was re-elected as Italy's Prime Minister earlier this year on a platform of cracking down on immigration, which he linked with crime. The centrepiece of his reforms was a promise to make entering the country without permission a criminal offence, as it is in the UK. But yesterday, Berlusconi astonished supporters and coalition partners by abandoning the pledge. John Hooper's The Guardian's correspondent in Rome.
They said that what they would do is to make unauthorised entry an offence, as it is in Britain, as it is in Germany and France. And that was central to the package of measures he introduced unveiled 2 weeks ago after a cabinet meeting in Naples. Now what he has said is that his personal opinion is that you can't lock people up for being illegal immigrants. And this has caused an enormous amount of dismay and anger, too, among his allies, particularly those in the Northern League, because the Northern League, more than any other party at the last election, stood on a platform of really getting tough with clandestine immigrants.
Will Silvio Berlusconi be able to hold his coalition of right-wing parties together after this?
Certainly, that is a question mark that this affair has raised. I think that what's at the back of his mind is the fear of what would have happened once this measure reached Parliament. In other words, that he risked a split in his ranks, particularly from the Catholics, the practicing Catholics, in his alliance, because only 24 hours, slightly less actually, than before he made these remarks, a senior Vatican official came out and said the plans of the government to make unauthorized entry into Italy an offence were unacceptable. It shows really the power that the Vatican has in Italian politics. It controls, if not directly, then certainly indirectly, the votes of many devout Roman Catholic MPs who would have listened to what he said and maybe trip Mr. Berlusconi up in Parliament.
And what will become of Mr. Berlusconi's other pledges on immigration, restricting the granting of asylum, confiscating property rented to illegal immigrants, and making it harder for legal immigrants to bring in family members from abroad?
All those seem to be going ahead. What he said is that he's also quite happy for illegal status in Italy to be a factor that would increase the penalty that anyone convicted of an offence would face. And indeed, this has already happened. Up in Milan, there have been cases at which illegal immigrants, or rather unauthorised immigrants, clandestine immigrants, have been given stiffer penalties, because that measure's already there. That was introduced by decree 48 hours after the cabinet meeting. So already there is a certain body of legislation taking effect. Others are coming in. The question now is, as you say, whether all of that is going to hold good, because there's even stirrings of discontent about this aspect that if you're an illegal immigrant, then you pay more, in effect, for your wrongdoing than you do if you're a legal immigrant or if you're an Italian.
John Hooper in Rome.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
A campaign to preserve a residential area of Beijing, just yards from Tiananmen Square, has enlisted the help of the Prince of Wales. Prince Charles wants to save Dashi Lan. It's an area of low-rise courtyard homes linked by alleys and teeming markets. The buildings are known as hutongs, and some date back to the 15th century Ming Dynasty. The Guardian's Robert Booth told me how Prince Charles got involved in preserving Dashi Lan.
Prince Charles's relations with the Chinese authorities over the years have been fairly patchy. If you remember, the closest he's been to China was Hong Kong in 1997, when he was there for the handover of Hong Kong to the Chinese. And he famously recorded in his travel diaries, which were leaked, that he considered the Chinese autocrats that were with the President Jiang Zemin like a bunch of appalling waxworks, which didn't obviously go down very well. So that was over 10 years ago. And since then, things have changed in China. And there was recently a delegation of visiting businessmen who came to London to go to Clarence House, the Prince's residence, and find out about his charitable work. The Prince had dinner with them at Clarence House, and they also went on a visit to Poundbury, which of course is the Prince's kind of model village built on Georgian classical lines in Dorset. And after that, there was an agreement that the Prince would get involved with his architecture charity and try and do something about the hutongs.
What effect has Beijing's rush to develop its new Olympic buildings, what effect has that had on its architectural heritage?
Well, I think that's at the very crux of what Prince Charles is trying to do here. As Beijing tries to become very quickly a 21st century city, using the Olympics as a catalyst for that, it's demolished swathes of historical housing, these hutongs, and replaced them with a different kind of housing, commercial buildings, offices, shops, high-rise, everything that we know and think of as a 21st century city. The result has been that there are only around 1,000 hutongs left now in Beijing. I think that's less than a third than there were just a decade or so ago. And it's changed the character very much of Beijing. And it's also changed the kind of demography of the city, because many of the people who lived and worked very close to the Forbidden City, right there in the centre, have been now pushed out to the second and third ring roads of Beijing, where they live in uniform housing blocks.
And as you say, the current residents of the hutongs do live in quite cramped conditions. Do we know what they think of efforts to preserve their homes?
Well, it was interesting. My colleague Jonathan Watts, who is our Beijing correspondent, was there, and he went to speak to some of them about just that and discovered that many of them felt sceptical about plans to regenerate this area. What Charles is proposing to do is to kind of thin out the cramped cramped Hutongs that are there and maintain and conserve the original architecture. Some of them were sympathetic with this idea, complaining about how cramped the conditions were, and others actually said if the compensation package was good enough, I'd be quite happy to go out and live on the outer ring road. But there is also a feeling amongst campaigners and NGOs in Beijing who are trying to hold on to the last vestiges of historic architecture in the city, that what Charles might be able to do here is to really bring to the forefront of public attention the value that are in these old buildings.
Robert Booth. Years ago in London, a series of recordings were made of West African musicians. The Zonophone Record Company, a forerunner of EMI, released them in West Africa in the late 1920s. Well, now they're being released on CD, giving most of us the opportunity to hear them for the first time. Mark Ainley put the CD together after spending 18 months trawling EMI's vast archive. I met him in the basement of his West London record shop. We're in the basement of Honest John's Records in West London, which is, to anybody who's interested in music, it's an Aladdin's cave, to coin a journalistic cliche, of music, and sort of surrounded by vinyl and CDs and so on. And with me is Mark Ainley from Honest John's, and he's the man who put together Living Is Hard, West African Music in Britain, 1927-29. Now, Mark, these were recordings made by Zonophone. They were recorded for a West African audience. They weren't recorded for sort of Western people who are, you know, the sort of Guardian readers, if you like, of the time, who may have been interested in African music. They were actually West African musicians recorded for West African audience.
Yeah, like a lot of the international recordings, there was huge output that EMI and the forerunners of EMI orchestrated in those three decades. They were intended to be all sent back to those countries where the music originated from.
They were also not only trying to sell gramophone records, but they were trying to sell gramophone equipment as well. I mean, was there much of a market there for gramophone equipment and records?
I think in the first few years of the 1930s, they sold something like 30,000 records to West Africa. You can find photographs of gramophone company record shops, you know, in Asia Minor, somewhere in Asia Minor, where the windows are full of horns and players, and obviously if you go in the 78s.
One thing that struck me listening to Living Is Hard is the quality of the sound recordings, because I think a lot of people, when they imagine sort of gramophone records, they imagine something very crackly, and that gives it a kind of patina of age to them, but these are incredibly clear.
The music on Living Is Hard was recorded by the Gramophone Company a few years before it merged with other companies and became EMI at the beginning of the 1930s in Hayes, in West London, at the same time that Robeson is recording and Elgar is recording, and they're electrical recordings. It's in the new manner, and so they really belong to the modern recording period, unlike, say, recording of say, 3 or 4 years previously.
And to put this CD together, you've spent 18 months going through this enormous archive at Hayes of EMI's recordings. Can you tell us a bit about the Hayes archive?
Well, it's housed in the same premises as the factory and offices that by the end of the 1920s were employing 7,500 people. At that time, they had their own timber yard. You know, they were building record players and things. They had their own fire service. They had their own railway inside the complex. It was an amazing, huge facility. I love this one called Obun Kofi because there's a real lovely tension between singing a song, which is arranged with his collaborators, and him just erupting into his sort of demotic tongues. When we had it translated, I found out that it's actually a beautiful lyric about settling over nations, which one presumes are warring, like a bird, and you settle over it with your wings, your feathers, and you calm the whole thing down, and the divisions disappear, which I thought was very nice.
Mark, Stanley, thanks very much for talking to us. And Living is Hard, West African Music in Britain, 1927 to 29, is out now on Honest John's Records. Guardian Daily today was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.